related to the way in which the entire sensory motor behavior is happening. You, for example, probably know that, say, the classical work of Hugo and Liesel, Torsten Liesel was one of my teachers, and, you know, I remember being very impressed by working with the cat as he did, you know, insert the electrode in the visual cortex, and you see that it responds very easily to edges that move in this part of the visual field at that speed and that position, and so on. The so-called sensory detectors of the visual cortex. And, you know, it was such a beautiful classical work that it made the impression, and certainly me and the people, that in fact this feature extraction was in fact the way the vision was working. What it is at the same time evident, but not so easily remembered in the text, for example, is that that experiment only works if you have the animal immobilized, anesthetized, with everything else cut off. So the moment you try to repeat the same experiment with an animal that is, doesn't have a metallic bar in its ears and is anesthetized and not moving at all, the moment you try to repeat that with a behaving animal with open, the rest of its sensory surface is open, particularly when it's engaged in self-produced behavior, that whole feature detection description simply falls apart. You'd never find that neuron in that very neat state where it responds to features of the environment that have been described as such. What you have to do, and this is what people do today, is to understand then distributed patterns that become much more apparent, but where one neuron never has the same role. So even Abeles in Rehoboth in Israel recently found that you can actually affect the sensory state when you look at the, say, the visual cortex by making the animal change just its position. So the animal is looking at the same, is trained to look at the same stimulus pattern, but it is trained to look at it by just changing its posture slightly. And you see that that just change of posture changes completely the sensorial state in the cortex. So in fact, this relationship between motorium and sensorium is so tight that we're just beginning to grasp the even ways to talk about it. But let me not get sidetracked on that, although it's also quite fun. Let me backtrack for a moment and reframe this discussion in terms of what we said about the minimal molecular phoietic system. What I'm claiming, basically, is that in contemporary neurosciences, like was the case for cell biology, gives us some basic elements to conceive of the basis or the basic organization for a cognitive self in terms of the, what I like to call the operational closure of the nervous system. Now, I speak of closure here to highlight, again, the self-referential quality of this interneural network, just exemplified before, and of the perceptual motor surfaces whose correlation is observed. The qualification operational in operational closure emphasizes that closure is used more in its mathematical sense of recursive, and not, of course, in the sense of closedness or isolation from interaction, which would be, of course, nonsense. So more specifically, what I'm saying is that the nervous system is organized by the operational closure of the network of reciprocally related modular subnetworks, which gives rise to ensembles of activities such that, two things, they continuously mediate invariant sensory-motor correlation, and two, they give rise to a behavior for the organism as a mobile unit in space. So the operational closure of the nervous system brings forth a very specific mode of coherence, which is, again, part of this organism's somatic coherence. This coherence is a cognitive self, is a unit of perception motion in space. Now, I insist on the perception notion in space, because although cognition expands vast realms of language and imagination and dreaming, my position is that the absolute key for the entire realm of cognition, including language, is the sensory motor framework. So the passage to cognition happens then at the point where the neurologic comes into action and creates a mobile self. Right. So let me get now, we'll begin to wind up by making a comment on the intentionality and this neurologic. So ordinary life is necessarily one of situated agents, continuously coming up with what to do, faced with ongoing activities in various perceptual motor systems. So this continual redefinition of what to do is not at all like a plan, stored in some kind of repertoire of potential alternatives, but enormously dependent on contingency, improvisation, and more flexible than any form of planning. Situatedness in this sense means the cognitive entity has, again, a perspective. That means that if it isn't related to its environment as a source of objective properties, independently of the system's location, heading, attitude, and history, this follows, of course, directly from the point of view that the cognitive self is sensory motor coherence. Now, what we did now for the minimal cellular cells, and this is where it can hope, help, because now we're moving in much more shifty territory. So if we refer back to the cellular self, we can get a little more clarification, I think. We have to sharply differentiate between environment and world. And again, this mode of coupling is double. On the one hand, a body in space clearly happen through interactions with the environment on which it depends. These interactions are of the nature of macro-physical encounters, sensory transduction, muscle form and performance, light and radiations, and so on. Nothing surprising. However, this coupling is possible only if the encounters are embraced from the perspective of this sensory motor circularity itself. So again, this amounts to elaborating a surplus signification relative to this perspective. Whatever is encountered must be valued one way or another, like, dislike, ignore, and acted in some way or another, attraction, rejection, neutrality, by this basic assessment, which is inseparable from the way in which the coupling event encounters a functioning, an ongoing functioning perceptual motor unit. Therefore, it gives rise to an intention, literally an intention, as in the Brentanian sense. Now, sometimes I've been too influenced by my psychoanalyst friends in Paris, and I'm tempted to say it gives rise to a desire. It's an intention literally in the sense of going forth and bringing up with this gesture of the perceptual motor unit something that is relevant for itself. Phrased in other terms, the nature of the environment for a cognitive self, he has a very curious status indeed, because it is that which lends itself to a surplus significance. In German, there's a very nice way of phrasing it. You say, es lend sich an. That's exactly what I would like to say, is lensic an. It can be used for that particular process of bringing forth signification. It's like jazz improvisation. Environment provides the excuse for music from the perspective of the cognitive system. The definition in this metaphor, if you want, is in the more classical computational experiment or cognitive experiment,
cognition is like reading Mozart. You know, you have this core, you read it.
This is not so, and this is not. You have a little room for interpretation, but this core is given. That is the information coming from the environment. From this point of view, cognition is just much more like jazz improv. You're thrown something, and then out of that, something completely, depending on your perspective, actually arises, because that bit of beginning for the jazz improv lends itself, lends it on. At the same time, of course, the organism cannot live without this constant coupling and the constant emergent regularities. Without the possibility of a coupled activity, the system would simply become a solipsistic ghost. So for example, in a recent paper in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, light and reflectances, among many other microphysical parameters such as edges, textures, and that let's simplify for the argument's sake, light and reflectances lend themselves to a variety of color spaces, the creation of a color dimension that is proper to the kinds of organism you are, whether they're a fish or a bird or an insect or a primate. And it can bring forth a variety of this of chromatic world depending on the kinds of internal sensory motor coherences that you have. That whole argument we developed in 75 pages in this article, I'm not going to repeat it here, but you know, you can actually transform this point of view in rather detailed argument for specific cases, and color happens to be a very beautiful one. So the article is called, not surprisingly, Ways of Coloring. You can also use AI as a source of examples, like very much to quote an early paper by Rod Brooks, where he says, quote, "I argue for a different approach to creating artificial intelligence." He says, "We must incrementally build up the capacity of intelligent systems that each step of the way and thus automatically ensure that the pieces or their interfaces are valid." Now that sounds like sensory motor coherence to me. "At each step, we should build complete intelligent systems that we let loose in the real world with real sensing and real action. Anything less provides a candidate with which we can delude ourselves." So that is the actual bringing forth of a system in its ongoing coupling. It's not doing it a priori by reading its core. It's doing it as jazz. "We have been following this approach and have built a series of autonomous mobile robots, and we have reached," this is what is interesting to me, "an unexpected conclusion and rather radical hypothesis. The conclusion is that when we examine very simple level intelligence, we find that explicit representations and models of the world simply get in the way. It turns out to be better to use the world as its own model." I don't know what to mean by that. "And the hypothesis is that representation is the wrong unit of abstraction in building the parts of intelligent systems. Representation has been a central issue in artificial intelligence, you could say in cognitive science, over the last 15 years, only because it has provided an interface between otherwise isolated modules and conference papers." A little hard though. What I am arguing here, and I agree with Brooks, but he has his own reasons for doing that, abstraction misses the essence of what cognitive creativity and intelligence is all about, which is that it resides on its embodiment. It is as if one could separate cognitive problems into parts, that which can be solved through abstraction and that cannot be, and this simply will not do. So, to conclude, the two main points that I've been trying to bring into view in this section is as follows. First, I have tried to spell out, in parallel to our first discussion, the nature of the identity of the body in motion and space, through the operation of coercion of the engineering network. So the three steps are important for me.
identity. It is in a body multicellular organism, and where the closure of the interneural network provides the body with motion in space. This activity is observable at multiple subnetworks acting in an interwoven complex bricolage, giving rise again and again to coherent patterns which manifest themselves as behavior. Secondly, I've tried to clarify how this emergent distributed dynamic is inseparable from the constitution of a world, which is none other than the surplus of meaning and intentions carried by such situated behavior. If the links to the physical environment are inevitable, the uniqueness of the cognitive self is this constant genesis of meaning. Or again, to invert the description as we did before, the uniqueness of the cognitive self is this constitutive lack of signification, which must be supplied faced with the permanent coupling and breakdowns proper to perception of life. So we live on constantly what is missing and providing that significance because we have this ongoing sensory motor coherence. So I like to say that cognition is action about what is missing. Cognition is action about what is missing. Filling the fault from the perspective of this cognitive self, much like in the case of the unicellular view, it was also the breakdowns that provided the excuse, if you want, for bringing forth signification. So I take this view to amount to a biology of intentionality. And I claim, in fact, to answer to the questions that I raised before, that it answers without ambiguity to two key problems in contemporary debates: the symbol and the syntax grounding problem. The symbol refers to, symbol's grounding problem refers to the mystery of the origin of signification of natural symbols. Since in the classical cognitivist option, there is an intrinsic need for a semantic assignment. So the answer provided by this approach is that, in fact, the signification arises from the point of view of the autonomous constitution of the organism at all of its levels, from autopoiesis on. So you cannot not have that surface that is intrinsic to the identity of the system. And the syntax grounding problem claims that, this is what Searle would like to believe, that all syntactic operations are completely observer dependent. That's why we can possibly explain cognition as we are trying to do. Well, the answer to me here is that precisely once you have the constitution of an autonomous unit, it provides the mean on which regularities will inevitably appear. And that was the case in the cell, say when you take the classical genetic code. You know, the fact that you have three triplets assigned for one amino acid is a regularity that has all of the syntactic qualities. Yet, such regularity can only arise because it exists within the totality of the cell. You take away the background of the totality of the cell, and such a code simply disappears. So there is no contradiction there between syntactic, absolutely grounded syntax, and the fact of having the functioning whole. In fact, the functioning whole is the condition of possibility for the emergence of syntax. So there is nothing mysterious, contra Searle, in the emergence of such composable regularity. Same thing could be said about the composability of emerging neuronal coherences. So, contrary to this debate, I do not believe that we need an arbitrary assignment of significance or of compositionality. The key is in the identity generated by the self-constitution of the organism, be at the cellular level or at the neuronal level. Well, you can read at the end of my paper what I tried to provide is again is a summary of these two terms which to me are the core of my argument, the parapsychology of the relationship between coupling and imaginary relation, how the two terms are both of them essential to understand intentionality, and yet how instead of appearing as contradictory from the frame or when you frame them in the context of the self-constitution of an identity, they actually become very naturally integrated. But I will not bore you with reading that and reading the paper, and I would like to finish up at this point, and I hope that it was useful to get us started in the discussion.
Okay, well, the purpose of a workshop is not just to listen to the prepared papers, but to actually interact with them and see where that takes us. I'm going to use the special position chairperson in these circumstances to ask first question myself, and then we'll take it from there. I would like to go back to this idea of using the minimal autopoietic organization as a ground for talking about the emergence of significance and this distinction between world and environment. And the point I want to clarify is simply this: what you are calling environment is also a world. It's our world. So there is some kind of irreducible relativity involved in these discussions. The separation, it seems to me, the famous or infamous bacterium, from our point of view, we say, well, yes, it is imbuing the Foucault's gradient with significance. And that is the distinction between this world and our more general, more embracing environment that we see it as being embedded in. But that is still grounded in our view of our world, which is potentially wrong. And the bacteria may know more than we realize at the moment. Am I interpreting you correctly, and is there a gap there, and is it important?
No, you are not interpreting me incorrectly, but it's just a matter of, how can I say, being, depends on what you're trying to do. You see, most of the time, I like to do research, and I like to behave in biology. And when you're studying Foucault's gradients, and when you're studying writing, it is quite convenient. Take this position, it's quite convenient to take the point of view that what you describe as, say, physical regularities such as edges or as reflectances or super gradients, I take them for the time being as non-problematic problems. Although you're right that if somebody's pushing me up to the second floor, eventually I'll have to concede that that is not grounded more than the super gradient. But that is, one is shifting the discussion to a meta level, which I don't need to do unless I need to. But in order to actually carry on with research, most of the time, you don't need to. The problem only becomes, as far as I'm concerned, when you forget that that will happen inevitably many times along one's life, in different crises in the state of mind. When we want to believe that there is some kind of ultimate foundational ground or value or ontological quality given to that description. I don't think that I've ever said anything, for example, today that ascribes that an ultimate foundational value. But then we're shifting to a different discussion, which is an interesting and productive one. But it is not the discussion, say, about explaining intentionality. Cannot be founded on that level, because then we decide what the specific is.
Well, yeah, okay, I stop there. other people then, maybe who wants to
You discussed intentionality, and you gave a very sophisticated biological kind of reduction, but not quite just
intentionality.
But you didn't really make any sort of reference to what you call extra poetic or the poetic communicative aspect of intentionality. An important aspect in philosophical discussion of intentionality. I like Sarah Wilkie, things like speech acts, which is the social
Fair enough. What I tried to do, again, to retrace the logic, is to say, to answer the difficult one, which would be, say, intentionality in language is the classical, although the classical intentionality, as you know, Brentano, Tancuso, is perceptual intentionality. Now, in order to, but let's move it up to linguistic intentionality and communicational intentionality. In order to answer that, my approach is to say, let's first look at where it is grounded, so that we don't carry up with us the semblance of a paradox where there is none. Like, for example, where is the meaning of symbols grounded? But wait. Then, let's move up, make the difficult transition between unicellular and multicellular. Now, what I haven't developed, and that's where your comment is fair, is how to go, say, between sensory motor, perception, and action into language. That's an argument that would need to be done. But I claim that that's exactly what can be done, and, you know, I'm not particularly working in that area, but say, if you read people like Lakewood and Johnson as a good example, how they could actually argue how language actually emerges directly from this kind of embedded, situated perception motor constitution. So that there is no, in principle, no barrier or fundamental problem in reconstructing the intentionality at all levels. But the difficult thing for me is to find its grounding, not to find its manifestation.
Well, I agree to that, what you're saying, is concerned. And I agree with it completely. It seems to me that you're trying to go for a foundational grounding in a linguistic explanatory system, which in some sense is a precedent over what you're trying to explain.
It's a little bit his point. Is it? I have absolutely no desire to pretend that that is not a very difficult and relevant point. Yet. You have to take it one at a time. And but it's true. I mean, there's a lot that could be said, but I think that there will be a different workshop. You see what I'm saying? I have a book recently out called The Embodied Mind, Human Experience and Cognitive Science, where I do try to do that in its full circularity. That is, the fact that you start from experience, including linguistic and social experience, and you want to come back to that. And we could spend the rest of the time talking, you know, in that direction, but since I am a good boy and I was invited to talk about perception of places, I've tried to restrain all I can say to your point, which I think is significant though, is that I see no fundamental barrier to extend the argument into that domain. I'm not saying it's easy. But I don't see a fundamental obstacle. The difficult part is, I claim, covered in this other two steps.
Larry, I'd love a glass of water. Just to be more practical.
Well, I wouldn't do that. We'll start off the early week. Anybody else want to come in at that point in the discussion? Certainly.
Well, I'm sort of in the middle, not wanting to go up to the multi-building, but still down at the level of the environmental tools. And my my problem is multiple conditionalities on a verbal, but where we're talking about the world or the other world, that world is other conditionalities in that circle. And that's what I didn't see clearly touched upon that. And it's sort of the area that I'm most intrigued by.
Let me see if I understand correctly. My thesis is that precisely that intentionality is rooted there.
Yeah.
So that there is no fundamental ontological or philosophical distinction between that intentionality and my intentionality of this as red. That is not at all what, say, I mean, Searle would hit the floor. Sorry, see. I say, no, you're wrong. It's a fairly, how can I say, unconventional way of extending one another. Is that what you're referring to?
No.
That is not
my problem.
Okay.
My problem is the problem of describing that in out the world is environment. And yet one seems too passive and one from the outside is overly determined to remain the outside. And yet if I'm looking at it from the point of view of the individual self, that environment does consist of other intentionalities of itself.
Well,
let
me see. I'm not sure that I'm understanding you correctly.
Okay.
For me, the roots of that intentionality is the fact that you have that constitution of an identity. As I said, it creates a perspective.
Yes.
So that in the interaction gives the occasion for something to be brought forth that is surplus. All right, and we know that how that happens. We know exactly how that happens. Say in the case of supercreated. We know absolutely every single detail of that process. In simulations, one can see that happening. In other words, what I like about that is that there's absolutely nothing that seems elusive or that escapes our touching upon it. So yes, there are multiple intentionalities that happens to the extent that there are multiple encounters happening at every single instant, say the bacteria itself. But I'm not sure that that's what you're referring to.
It is trying to get to that, to that richness, rather than saying the ordinary man is getting more passive.
Well, I didn't say it was passive. I said the opposite.
Yeah.
I said that it was actually its own self-constitution that created, that made it possible to make the distinction between world and environment. Yet at the same time, you see that the temptation is to go to the other extreme and forget that that dialectics is a true dialectic, because it cannot just do anything it, you know, quote unquote, desires or wishes. That there is an interesting relationship between, like a musician, you know, which is thrown a little piece for improvisation, it cannot just do anything it pleases. It has to sort of take into account the phrases that were proposed and then do improv on that. Okay. And that is the interesting beauty of that dialectic. And that we makes us escape from the solipsistic extreme or the physicalistic reduction. Both.
Okay. Just a very quick point. I'm curious of your use of the term imaginary.
Yes.
And your next to black.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned that you were talking to French psychoanalysts.
You noticed.
Could you say just a little bit about what your interest and what you found about their approach to this issue of imaginary?
Well, it's just that you see, I guess, also along the lines of this question here, I'm very interested in exploring, because I don't have any final definite conclusion, exploring to what extent this continuity is, you know, a substantial one between the roots of intentionality all the way to human
social life. Seems to me that the psychoanalysts or the psychoanalytic tradition, they have a very interesting point, which also you can say some of the phenomenologists have it too. I mean, the Lopunti, for that matter, is more than a hero here. In understanding that we constantly are moving in the wake of the lack, the breakdown. Nothing happens unless there is something that disappeared, that is lacking, that is insufficient, that we're striving for. Okay. That is, in fact, the root of intentionality. Now, the analyst put an emphasis on that by underlying the desire part. The phenomenologist, you know, put the emphasis on understanding the nature of how the process appears, and it has this very interesting way of arising, manifesting, and disappearing again. Illuminating pages in the Lopunti phenomenology of perception. Now, since I take that to be a very interesting observation about our experience, I am curious to see what extent we cannot sort of project it backwards and see the continuity. And so far, I see no obstacle in reading this autopoietic creation of the world in those terms, because in fact, that's what it is. Nothing happens in the cell unless the membrane starts to break apart, unless the metabolites tend to go down. That's what makes regulation work. I mean, it's just, that's just good biology. So I find it curious to put it into that light. So what I said is turning the argument upside down is, it's a little bit, it's like reading that root of the process from the point of view of result rather than the other way around. Yes, please.
Term identity, when you're speaking as a biologist, as a psychologist, you use the term identity too.
Yes.
And how do you feel about
it? Okay, that's a very important point, because it seems to me again that it's a question of continuity. What psychologists would call identity, as I don't have to tell you, it's 25 different things. But most of the time, I guess, it would be something like a cognitive identity, right? That is a sense of self in the cognitive domain, which includes perception, but it also includes imagination, includes emotional values, and so forth. I use the term identity in the second part, talking about the nervous system, precisely in that sense. Now, my little interlude about organism was about the fact that if one really wanted to write a book, when I'm old, I'm going to write a book called The Nature of Identity, which, because I think that in fact, we, as an ongoing piece of life here, we have interwoven multiple identities. There is a cognitive identity, but there's also the somatic identity, there's also the cellular identity, there is the social identity. It is the invocation of these multiple identities that needs to be addressed. You are right. But here I'm only talking about, I've talked about two of them. And it is a perfectly polysemic word. But again, I'm still interested in seeing how all of these modes of identity actually relate to each other. They are not just separate things.
Yes.
Yes.
Could you explain the you said that the breakdown in the autopoietic process would be to the unification of an organism. And by that I understand that it implies it were going to work with the best system that it intended for it were with. That's what the five different relationships were, the breakdowns in its own autopoietic process. And that then we are to observe it in our environment. We are sort of characterized it in itself, where as part of our environment, then its signification must as well constitute the breakdown in our own autopoietic process.
Yes.
So we say that their signification or their intentionality allows us to observe them within our
my book, The Confederate of Black Man's Blood. And that it was the currency of Zara. But, you know, may sound like a big question, they have two different businesses then. They just go from the orthopedic form of the two systems to be attending at the same time. And this is the difficulty I see going from the unicellular to the multicellular is that you need to have more than one system intending in the same place and at the same time, and not in different places and at the same time. So when one system like us is observing some other system like the sort of gradients and bacteria, that's a difference. The two different levels we're looking from the outside in. And in order to successfully describe the multicellular system in the same formalism, I think you need something different.
Something different from?
The trichotomy of the observer looking at.
Okay, let me see if I can follow your question. I'm not trying to deny the importance of bringing in the observers. Relativistic framework here. All I'm saying is that for most purposes we can assume a certain stability of consensuality to do a limited amount of work. Like for example, when I study, I'm getting to your point here, just give me a second. And when I'm studying color, I can take as unproblematic, although it is problematic, that we all see this effect. Why? Because we share enough biological identity as human beings that's unproblematic. Of course, if we're talking about beauty, we know that would be the case when we're talking about justice. But for many processes, we can bracket out that observer presence. Just bracket out for the purposes of making our life a little simpler. So from that point of view, the emergence of significance in itself, I take it as unproblematic because I can bracket out that there is a consensus that what the Sucrose gradient is consensual enough that I can take it as a background. Okay. Now you are right though that when we go from unicellular to multicellular, one of the beauty of that step is how do different lineages of cells, which carry different intentionalities, come to share a new and new emergent or transcendent unit, which is the organism. Now, to me, there is no more mystery than in establishing again the rules of this passage between the local and the global. In the case of the autopoietic device, we know how to explicitly give the rules of passage between global to local and local to global. Okay. In the case of the organism, that's what I said, was the mystery. We haven't yet the autopoietic, organismic autopoiesis. We don't know what that is. But if we knew it, then again, we could bridge that apparent gap between the new emergent unit and the local one to conciliate what seems to be disparate intentionality into one which is neither the sum nor the diversity of it. Is that what you were?
Well, I think my question was, what is it that you just said? What was missing?
Well, I was just a confession of ignorance. I don't think biology, and I just mentioned, for example, the question about immunology, just to give you, from my perspective, a symptom of this ignorance. It's very interesting, you know, that biology, for many, many years, and this is a break from the 19th century, go back and read biology of the 19th century, you know, the great biologists, even like Lamarck or like Weismann, people like that, they had that question in their minds constantly. The 20th century, the idea of how to constitute an organism as a unity in an interesting, complex system way, it's only now that it's beginning to come up. And again, I give Buss's work as one of the most brilliant example of recent literature that addresses the issue as if it was new. So it's a confession of ignorance.
Can I just jump in there and ask, is it plausible that there's a single answer to that question? On the face of it, it seems to me that this phrase multicellular organism is hiding too many.
No, I think that there is a single question that there is for the appraisal study, there is one fundamental logic. And I think Booth, for example, puts his finger on one element of that logic, which is what he addresses in that book, is all the evidence on how, in fact, the constitution of the multicellular organism passes, I'm not saying it is the only thing, he doesn't say either, passes by, or comes down to inventing one fundamental law, which is the law of coexistence of the universe, so that neither they disappear nor that they eat everybody else. And that is done through a very interesting device, which is creating a common space. A common space is what we in biology know as anatomy as the extracellular matrix, which is all the stuff which is not cells. Now that extracellular space contains actually a common space where this lineage can be regulated. So the coexistence of lineages, which is in fact the question that sociologists could ask, by the concept of the nation by bringing in different ethnic groups, it's one of the fundamental logics. Now, that's why I tend to believe that there is one concise compact answer. But
also the problem of how the cells differentiate as an autogeny from a single cell. I think it's tied in a bit with that.
It's exactly the same problem.
The various people working on that problem, if we can see clues there, we may see clues in how all these cells cooperate in a complete organism. But also...
No, I agree with you. It is the same problem. It's the ontogeny of the individual body, which is also the phylogeny.
Yeah. If you take an organism of cooperating cells, not so the organism, it's made up of subcategories, like the heart, the liver, and so on. Could you apply your idea of autopoiesis to categories, subcategories of a multicellular organism?
The classical organ.
Like the organ, which can be transplanted. After all,
I don't think so. Actually, I think that this idea of dividing a multicellular organism into organs is a complete barking up the wrong tree.
Uh-huh.
Because it has a lot to do with the way physiology developed, just sort of natural to address circulation as opposed to metabolic control as opposed to but that it doesn't address the fundamental issue for the organism. One, and I think again that there that Bruce is right, of coexisting lineages, which is not the same thing as organs. For example, we have lineages of cells which can be picked up by the markers on the surface in the so-called major histocompatibility molecules, the NH2 complex, which exist in every tissue, in every organ. Now, those guys are very important for the overall regulation. They are not concentrating on one organ. Mm-hmm. So the organ description is useful but superficial. One has to go beneath that to see what the real social life is. If you want, it's like, I don't know, an analogy sometimes I think it's like saying, well, if you take a country like France and then you say, okay, there is the economy and then there is the civil servants and then there is the educational system. Yes, that's true, but is it not a superficial description of what the real social life is, which is really embedded into people's language, into people's...